This week about conversion and about multiple possibility of multiple religious identities. Messianic Jews, self-designated Messianic Jews, are an interesting case study, as Brenda has engagingly pointed out to us. They stalwartly insist that they are not converts. As you noticed in the whole, in the vocabulary self-generated by Messianic Jews that I gave out to you, they totally reject the idea of being a convert or having engaged in conversion. And that poses the first issue. Secondly, multiple religious identity. Most Messianic Jews do not claim multiple religious identity. They say, we are Jews. Next step, we are Messianic Jews. But they start with an identity which they see as in continuity. So are they or are they not an example either of conversion or of multiple religious identity? That's our problem. They most of them do not claim, to my knowledge, a dual identity. We are Jews. We are Messianic Jews. That is, we are one among a variety of expressions of Judaism. And there certainly is a variety. Our particular calling, they frequently say, is to the Jewish people, to the Jewish nation. We have a particular kind of responsibility that other Jews may not have. Now, I put up on the board here, tiny group, big picture. And I'd like to underline the tininess of this group. We've been hearing from Akbar about 1,200,000,000 Muslims in the world. We're now talking about a group that is variously estimated from 20,000 to perhaps at most 150,000. That's, do you think, Brenda, do you think that's about right?
I think towards the lower end.
Towards the lower end, yes. It depends on whose estimate one reads and all of that. Statistics, as we know, in religious circles are notoriously undependable. So this is a very small group. So why the big deal? This is a statistically insignificant movement. Statistically insignificant movement. Then why the big deal? What is the threat, or what are the questions raised? I think it is an interesting question, and it raises some questions that I will get to toward the very end here. The whole question that comes up is, what is so-called classical Judaism? What is classical Christianity? I'll introduce a slight waiver from something Brenda just said when she talked about classical Christianity and evangelical Christians going before it or not being involved in classical Christianity. I'll come back to that. I think one man's classical period is another man's deviation when you're looking at the history of a religious movement, or one woman's deviation, his or her deviation. So this raises the whole question, a kind of a fiction of an unbroken, continuous narrative in a religious tradition. At least raises a question about that. Is there such a thing at all? It raises the question of the relationship between religious identity and culture. It raises the, of course, very pressingly, the issue being raised in many parts of the world today, the United States and Israel in particular, about what is a Jew? What is a Jew? And others. Now, I'm turning now to my chart on the wall. I've fallen completely in love with these colored markers here, and I'm going to steal them and take them home because I just like to play around with them. Tiny group, big picture. Here's the big picture. I'm going to talk about three changes within which I would like to locate Messianic Judaism, a tiny movement in a big picture. The first is what I call a change in the nature of religiousness, which one can trace across the entire spectrum of religious movements and traditions, I think. And I would make a case for that if I had longer period. I'm going to talk about the nature of some of those changes. One of which Brenda has just alluded to, what seems to be a dissolving of the relationship between geography and religious identity for a variety of reasons. Worldwide travel, education, instantaneous communication, internet, migrations, refugees, all of that is changing that pattern very rapidly. Second is the changes that I see going on in world Christianity, some of which are reminiscent or at least similar to some of the qualities of Messianic Judaism, and then some things I, as an outsider, see in the current situation of Judaism, and I'm talking here mainly about Judaism in the United States. And then finally, I want to raise this question, which is a theological question, very important theological question, at least for me, and I hope for you. What do we mean by classical? Classical anything. Okay, let's start with the change in religiousness. Deregulation is a term taken from economics, but really from Reaganomics, I think one would say, in which various enterprises and entrepreneurial concerns are simply freed from government regulation and allowed to do their thing and compete for a piece of the market. I'm grateful to a scholar, a French scholor, named Hervé Léger, who is the editor of the Archive in Paris, this study of the social scientific study of religion, who very agilely applied this term to the current religious scene. It's a kind of deregulation in which all kinds of new packaging, new kinds of combinations of ideas, new forms of marketing, attempts to get a part of the market, market share, are competing with each other in what is more or less, not completely, an open and free market economy in religion, with all of the good things and all of the bad things that a so-called open market brings with it, because there are hidden pressures and there are people who have more skills at deceptive packaging than others, and there are all kinds of appeals, and if you don't make it, you will go underwater. Nonetheless, I think it's a more or less helpful metaphor. And it certainly is obvious not just in the United States, which used to be the major area for the creation of new religious movements and new attempts to get at the market share, but the descriptions I've heard of what's happening in Israel today, Brenda, if I'm right, is that Israeli society is seeing a good deal of this. Certainly Europe is, other parts of the world as well. Japan, indeed Japan, a wonderful example of, perhaps the best, maybe in a way, of of an open new market in religious energies. The second is what I call, again following Hervé Léger, collage building. If this puts this open market puts a lot of responsibility on individual persons, and we see a drawing on what I think Brenda just called, what you call it, the sea of symbols, or the ocean, or the pool. What was it? Yeah, the pool of symbols. I envision a kind of floating pool with symbols floating around. I think I mentioned this a couple of days ago, what some critics call floating signifiers that are not as connected now to their traditional housing in an institutional or doctrinal framework. There they are, floating around. They're floating through the networks, the internet, they're floating through the media, they're floating around through popular songs, new religious movements, and there's a tendency, a very strong and continuing tendency, growing tendency on the part of people to assemble their own collage. A collage is something you put together of elements that you find from various places, put it together in a way that creates something that for you is unified, that has a certain kind of aesthetic symmetry and has a utility. If you can think of a collage, however, which is not ever completed, a collage that you're constantly building and adding to and taking off from and moving along with, this is more what's going on. Now, religious professionals are terrified by this, against it, and use terms like cafeteria-style religion. This, you hear this a lot in Roman Catholic circles. This is not a cafeteria-style religion. You can't just choose what you want and leave the rest. You can't take your tray along and pick this out and not have this. However, whatever the hierarchy says, whatever the Pope says even, this is exactly what hundreds of millions of Roman Catholics are now doing all over the world. They're saying something like this: I'm a Roman Catholic, and I don't believe everything the Pope says, or the bishop says, or the priest says, but they're not going to stop me from being a Roman Catholic. I have a perfect right, and I'm going to continue. Now, this is different. I can remember very well when I was a university student, and even when I was in seminary, I had Catholic friends who struggled very hard with whether they could really believe what the Catholic Church taught. And if they came to the conclusion that they really couldn't, they would often say, the only honest thing for me to do, if I don't believe the whole business, is simply to go somewhere else, is to leave. That's the intellectually and spiritually honest thing to do. That's very rare nowadays. Very rare in the age of collage building. You'll hear more. There are a variety of ways of being Roman Catholic. Now, I've used the Roman Catholic Church because it's a particularly vivid example, but I think the same thing is going on in my own denomination, among Baptists, among Presbyterians, Lutherans. If you could actually find out with the truth serum what those people in the congregation who are saying the creeds and singing the hymns are doing, you'll find a lot of collage building going on. And a lot more of it now is becoming acceptable, even to those who are in the leadership, although they tend to fight a kind of a rear guard action against it. Either you take the whole package or nothing. This is of course what the custodians of the tradition want to say, and one can understand that, even if they don't understand agree completely on what the whole package is. Take the whole package or nothing. And more people are saying no thank you and taking this, some of this, and some of that. I'm not here offering a judgment about this. Some of the collages I've seen are absolutely dreadful from my point of view. Nonetheless, I'm trying to engage in an empirical generalization about a very widespread trend I see, which I think will continue across the board of various religious traditions. Third is what I call juxtaposition. There was a time in which one could probably grow up in a religious tradition, many people could, without having very much living contact with another one. Now, this is very hard to generalize, because Jews have lived for centuries in cultures in which they have willy-nilly had to be in contact with a very large group, number of other people. And a lot of Jewish sensibility and Jewish teaching and Jewish self-identification has been in response to that. If you are ever in a Talmud study group, you can see problem after problem has to do with how do you live in a society and a culture which you're constantly pushed to define who you are with reference to what you participate in, what you do, what you don't do. Do you go to the baths where there's a statue of one of the pagan goddesses or not? That's a famous discussion in the Talmud. But for many people, if you were born a couple hundred years ago in one of the 99% Muslim countries, the chances of meeting a non-Muslim were rare. If you were born in southern Wisconsin, like one of our guests here a couple days ago, the most exotic religion, if you were Catholic, were the Lutherans down the street, and vice versa. If you were born in the middle of India, you might have to deal with Hindus and Muslims, but still, I think the generalization can be made that for very large numbers of people, the existential question posed by radical religious pluralism had not yet surfaced. Now we have these religious traditions are cheek by jowl, elbow by elbow, all around the world. Everybody is everywhere now. I can remember seeing a map when I was a small kid in an encyclopedia that my family had. I was 8 or 9 years old. I opened it up. It had religions of the world. They were color-coded. And the Hindus were conveniently all down there in India, and the Muslims were spread across the Middle East and down into Afghanistan and in Indonesia. The Buddhists were all over here. The Christians were more or less here and here. The Jews were color-coded as little spots here all over the map. Now what I want to say is that map, which was probably useful when I was a small kid, is totally useless anymore. Almost totally useless. Almost totally useless. You can't go 3 or 4 blocks in a major American city nowadays without finding a religious building or organization of a non-Christian, non-Jewish religious tradition. Pagodas, mosques are blooming everywhere. Christians, as I'll say in another moment here, are all over the world now. In fact, increasingly, the balance is in other parts of the world. So that you meet these people. You meet them personally. I can remember a student who came in to me a few years ago, a pre-med student from Harvard, and said, "I really want to take one of these courses in comparative religion." I said, "Why?" You have a pretty heavy schedule as a pre-med student. He said, "Well, look, my lab partner is a Muslim, my roommate is a Buddhist, and my girlfriend is a Jew. I better find out a little bit about comparative religion." I said, "You sure better." So that would not have been the case at Harvard or anywhere else 30 or 40 years ago. Increasingly, that is the case. Dating each other, meeting each other, working in labs together, falling in love with each other, marrying each other at an increasing rate. Juxtaposition. Now, juxtaposition causes two things. First of all, it causes me to consider whether the path I'm in is really the path I want to continue in. If that had never been posed to me by meeting the other, it might not have come up, and I can imagine there are millions of people in history for whom this never really came up in a serious way. Now it does. Now it does. And if you choose to continue in the path you were born into, or your parents raised you in, that is still a choice. You are a Jew by choice, even if you were born a Jew, in one sense. You're a Christian by choice, even if you were born into a Christian family, if you make that decision, or if you choose another path. That's what juxtaposition does. It also causes anxiety. It also causes fear. It causes xenophobia. Who are all these people who are doing things different from the way I do them? And so you get various kinds of reactions, including what I'll come to in a moment here called the backlash reaction. In fact, let me skip the existential turn and talk about the backlash, because I think it's very important. Here we have, here in this room, we have something which is important, exciting, interesting. It's being replicated in various places all around the world. Conversations among seriously religiously engaged people from various traditions, hearing each other, talking with each other, learning about each other. We also have groups of people in every one of our traditions who are saying, "Enough already. Stop that stuff. Get away from those interfaith dialogues. Don't dilute the faith. Don't sell the farm." Someone called this the circling of the wagons move. That is, the fundamentalist response to a more ecumenical and a more dialogical approach. I want to be very careful not to dismiss this with a term like simply circling the wagons or a dismissive term. I think anybody can understand why this would why the current fluidity and vociferousness of religious traditions will evoke a kind of a whoa. Let's go slower. Let's really find out who we are. Let's stay together and not do this kind of thing too brashly or too quickly. I can understand that. I give a course every few years at Harvard on the movements within each of the religious traditions that might be designated fundamentalism, that is, the fundamentalist Hindus. Who ever heard of fundamentalist Hindus until the last couple centuries, or a couple decades, really? Fundamentalist Jews. That would have been a contradiction in terms, I think. Fundamentalist Christians, yeah, we've had them for a long time, since the turn of the century. But fundamentalist Christians, I think you'll agree, David, were responding to what they saw as selling the farm, abandoning the ship, abandoning the faith. Here are the fundamentals. This is the bottom line that we can simply not compromise on. And if you're going to be a Christian, this is what the fundamentals are. And there's a certain kind of attractiveness to that when you're dealing with such fluidity. I call it the backlash, but if somebody could give me a more positive term than backlash or circling the wagons, I'd appreciate it. I want to honor it as a valid way of being religious. I think about the so-called integralist Catholics, who think that everything in the Catholic Church is going down the chute since the Second Vatican Council, which ended in 1965. It was a disaster from their point of view. And there are even Marian apparitions now, in which the Virgin Mary is said to say to people, don't believe this guy's the real Pope, he's a spurious Pope, and he's leading us down. This is a significant movement within the Roman Catholic Church, you might say a right-wing opposition within the Catholic Church as well. Now, the existential turn is a thrust that I can discern, I think, across the board in religious movements toward a reappropriation of the central experience, I underline the word experience, in a religious tradition, and a stepping back from some of the institutional and doctrinal structures within which that experience has been conveyed. Think about the growth of Buddhism in the West, for example, and the form of Buddhism, which have become popular in the West. Most of them are practice-oriented. Chanting, meditation, certainly Buddhist meditation, widely practiced and very attractive to large numbers of people. Think about Jewish renewal movements and the kind of bodily activity and singing and movement and experiential element that's there. The fastest growing wing of Christianity by far is the Pentecostal charismatic part of the Christian family, in which they pray the way we were jumping around here this morning. It's embodied. It's experiential. I did a whole book on Pentecostals a few years ago called Fire from Heaven, and visited hundreds of Pentecostal congregations all around the world in four different continents, and talked with people, and time after time, when I asked them what brought them here, it wasn't the teaching to begin with. It wasn't the institution. It was the experience. They came there and something happened. Something happened to them, which they couldn't deny. Something happened to their neighbor, which had changed that neighbor's life, or their sister-in-law's life, or their, and they had come and told them about it, and they went to seek the same thing. The experiential or the existential turn is there. Now, this is this is across the board. I could probably give examples in other religious traditions as well, but I think you'll find that it's across the board. Also arousing suspicion in religious establishments, of course. Religious establishments, at least in my tradition, have always been very suspicious of mystics, experiential movements, existential movements. Why? Because they tend to be volatile. They're not as controllable, they're not as institutionalizable as the kind of standard brand which is distributed by the registered corporation, put it that way. So there tends to be considerable suspicion and opposition to the existential turn. And sometimes we have nasty words for them, fanatics, or Pentecostals were called holy rollers in the early days of their... And some of them have claimed that, and it's a rather, yeah, I'm a holy roller, right, a holy roller for God. Why not? I'm enthusiastic about this. If I can be enthusiastic about the Red Sox, why can't I be enthusiastic about Jesus? You know, there's a reintroduction of the, not just the emotional, I don't want to make this sound just like an emotional component, I'm talking about the experiential and the existential. I think one of the main reasons for the phenomenal success of Pentecostalism around the world is their capacity to absorb existing religious practices and indigenous metaphors and musical tropes into their worship. You worship with Pentecostals in Africa, that's African. There's drums, there's dancing. You worship with Pentecostals in Russia, they sound like they're singing the Volga boatmen. In the Caribbean, it's distinctively Caribbean. And it does this in part because not having a hierarchy or an enforced creedal structure, a lot of this kind of experimentation is possible. Now, I think this is an important link, by the way, to Messianic Jews. Messianic Jews, Brenda's right, tend to be an evangelical Christian movement, indeed with charismatic and Pentecostal overtones, very frequently. Very often you'll find that. Now, Christianity, the most important thing happening in the Christian world is what I call de-Westernization. Sometime about 20 years ago, a balance was changed, which had been predicted, but had been predicted for many years hence, in which the majority of people who call themselves Christians in the world no longer live in Europe and the United States, the old center of Christendom, where, at least in Europe, numbers of Christians are declining. At that point, the majority of Christians became brown and yellow and black, and they live on the Asian Rim, or even increasingly in China, or in South America, or in Africa. So the balance is shifting. It's simply inaccurate, empirically, to speak about Christianity today as a Western religion. It isn't. It didn't start as a Western religion, and it's certainly not one anymore. Although this is the way it's listed in a lot of catalogs sometimes among the Western religions. That's empirically inaccurate. Now, that's not just a demographic fact. This means that the theologies, the liturgies, the ways of relating gospel to culture are all changing very, very rapidly. In my view, the most interesting Christian theology now is being developed in what we used to call the Third World. Asian Christian theologies, African Christian theologies, especially Latin American ones. And of course, Latin America, one could say, was always a Christian continent. It is changing very rapidly now from being a Catholic culture into a more moving in an evangelical and Pentecostal direction. One of my colleagues in Brazil taught me this word in Portuguese, desnortificação. He said the big task in Christian theology today is the denorthification of theology. We've had 1,500 years in which all Christian theology was phrased in the terms of Hellenistic culture, European thought forms, American thought forms, and now our task is to make it our own, the denorthification process. There used to be an old kind of a metaphor that was used about, the missionaries used to use, the foreign missionaries who went out from Europe and the United States to Africa and Asia, that They were trying to take the plant of the gospel and not the plant in the flower pot with the dirt, but they succeeded in taking the whole thing along. So they imported a lot of Christian of Western culture, which was where the plant had been growing. The second generation of Christians in these third world, so-called third world areas, often engage in a kind of revolt against that, pulling the plant up out of the pot, getting it, disengaging it from its Western Christian, Western cultural packaging. Now what's happening in the third stage is what I would call transplanting. Planting that plant in the soil of India, in the soil of Black Africa, in the soil of Asia. And what comes up is a somewhat different kind of plant, raising all kinds of questions. I mean, how Christian is it? Who's to decide? But the growth here is so phenomenal in the non-Western world that it's staggering. The largest Christian congregation in the whole world is the Yoido Full Gospel Church in Seoul, Korea. 750,000 members in one congregation.
One building.
They have 9 services a day with 30 to 40,000 people in each service. They have buses coming and going as fast as they can move. This is a Pentecostal church, which has absorbed and integrated into its liturgy rather generous elements of folk shamanism, of Korean folk shamanism, because the popular people's religion in Korea and in large parts of Asia is not Buddhism and not Confucianism, but a kind of shamanism. And so Western Pentecostals are saying, no, wait a minute, is this the Christianization of shamanism, or is this the shamanization of Christianity? And it's an interestingly open question. When this reaches the theological stage, the more reflective theological stage, the central teaching of Christianity, which is about Jesus Christ, the meaning of Jesus Christ for history, for human beings, becomes one of the most fractious, but also one of the most creative. That is, in referring to Jesus Christ and what he needs, to Jesus, let me just say Jesus for the moment, because Christ itself is a Hellenistic term, of course. Can one draw on metaphors and titles from the indigenous culture to understand Jesus? Bodhisattva, Crucified Guru, remember that book, The Crucified Guru? The elder brother in Black African Christology. These are Christologies which are growing out of a soil different from the Hellenistic culture within which the creeds were developed. In fact, what Asian Christians, many Asian and African Christians are saying is, do I really have to become a Hellenist in order to be a Christian? This is the point you made, Brenda. One of the reasons for going back before the Hellenistic creedal development is precisely to detour that, as it were, cultural packaging of the message. Now, the fascinating thing in here is that Christianity began as a repackaged and enculturated movement. We don't have any of Jesus' sayings or teachings in the language he spoke. They're all in Greek. So the original enculturation was quite original. It's in the New Testament. It wasn't a subsequent development. So that in a sense, Christianity is, may I use the word, essentially culturally exportable and re-indigenizable and re-enculturatable. That's part of its, I can't use the word essence now, part of its creativity or part of its power, I think, is this capacity. Now, how does this, now with Judaism, we are looking at a phenomenal development of new groups, new expressions, which claim to be Jewish. I am not in a position to judge whether they are or not. I hope that's clear. The whole Buddhist movement. Jews so intensely influenced by Buddhism and Buddhist practices that they're incorporating them not only in their own private devotions and prayer life and so on, but into synagogue worship without announcing, you know, that they're Buddhist. Humanistic Jews, secular Jews. The American publication Shema just had a whole issue on secular Jews, the movement of secular Jews. Humanistic Jews, and so on. Now, these are not like the so-called secular Jews of a generation or two ago who said, "I'm not religious in any way. I'm Jewish, but I'm not religious." These are Jews who are saying, "I'm Jewish and I am religious, and this is the way I'm religious." Now, within this group, one group that's making this claim is Messianic Jews. As one of the many expressions of how to be Jewish in the world. I think they would, I think this is one of the things they'd like to, one of the frameworks in which they'd like to be understood. Now let me finish by just posing this question of what is classical. That's my notes all blew away here. And I think I'll do this by reading, this is from a book, maybe you know this, Brenda, the book by Rabbi Carol Harris Shapiro on Messianic Jews. No, she's a Reconstructionist rabbi writing about this group from the outside, and rather critical at points, but trying to understand it. That's who she is. We recognize the unsteady character of our modern constructions as Jews, while at the same time claim to maintain the chain of tradition that links us to the earliest days of Judaism. To be challenged on the truth of the latter proposition, that is this chain. To be told that contemporary Judaism is something fundamentally other than the idealized world of pre-modern Judaism threatens to destroy the sense of generational continuity, which for many Jews is the source of transcendent fulfillment. She's trying to say why this movement, although very tiny, is so problematical. From her point of view as a rabbi. By examining the most extreme case, Messianic Jews, one of the only groups of Jewish origin that have clearly been cited as out of the pale, one can see that in fundamental ways, most American Jews, if not all of us, are, quote, out of the pale. We are not pure. We self-consciously search, we innovate, we cover our secular values with Jewishness, we weave Judaisms out of the traditions of our forebears and the values of contemporary society, actively constructing identities while calling this creative Jewish continuity. We not only forge our generational link in the chain of tradition, but periodically refashion the entire chain, fastening its far end to the places most relevant to us. The prophets, the peacemakers, the mystics, the warriors, and so on. Whoever in that early part of the chain best confirms who we are. I'm quoting a book by a self-identified Jew and rabbi about her own tradition. I would say the same thing, almost identical words about the current